and I'll just indicate what we have tabled for the agenda. I know that we haven't I haven't seen most of members for a long time, and welcome to all of you. We only have two items on the agenda. Like I've already apologized for coffee, but we'll definitely also include the coffee break on our agenda. So the first one will be a briefing by the Public Service Commission on the state of the public service report, that is 2009. I'm sure just to give a background on this, this will not be the first briefing by the Public Service Commission. We did, prior to our motion that was presented by Honorable Breyer in the House, call for a brief, which was quite good. So it is a follow-up and progress on the areas thereof. I can indicate that within our document, we do have the State of the Public Service presentation, which is this, which has been distributed to all of us, and we do have also the report thereof, that is the report on financial misconduct, that is 2007 to 2008. So for the first session of the Public Service Commission, where I'm told that they'll be leaving immediately because there's another committee that has called on for a presentation. Then we'll actually start with them. After, we'll just break a bit. And then it will be followed by the briefing by the Department of Public Service and Administration on the governance and administration cluster. So in this case, we need to just briefly indicate that as you can see, that the Public Service Commission is going to make a brief here and go to another committee. If we already started to function in a cluster fashion, it wouldn't be that way. You know, they would come to only one parliament and brief everyone, you know, in a coordinated way. So part of our second brief is to do things in an integrated and, you know, quite reasonable and mainstreamed way of doing things. Because sometimes we do things in silos and we find that we repeat instead of implementing progress thereof. So that will be what we'll be doing for today, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen. I assume that the Public Service Commission is now ready. I can see that the presentation is already there with its slides, and I'll hand over to Dr. Nkijima. Dr. Nkijima is the chairperson of the Public Service Commission. I'm sure most of us who've been attending the committee meeting are now used and familiar with him and his tactics as well. So let's hear today what he is going to put forward for us. And thank you for honoring the invitation, Dr. Nkijima. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Once again, I think it is our honor to be here, to be presenting to the committee again. On previous occasions, I have been in the company of our Acting Director General, Mr. Dipofa, and on another subsequent occasion, I've been accompanied by Mr. Admiral Simpson. That was on the occasion of the overview on financial disclosure. Today, I'm in the company of Mr. Indran Naidu, who is our Deputy Director General. He is in charge of monitoring and evaluation in the Public Service Commission, and he will be doing the presentation. Next to him is Ms. Charmaine Julie, who is the Director in the Office of the Public Service Commission here in the Western Cape. So without much ado, I will hand over to Mr. Indran Naidu to the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable Chairperson, honorable members, Deputy Minister, Director General, good morning to all of you. A very brief overview of the State of Public Service Report 2009. In essence, these are reports that are a series of high-level annual oversight reports which provide an overview on the performance of public service and the way we assess performance is against the 9 constitutional values and principles. And it's based on the oversight work of the PSC, but also draws on other research. Now, each edition is also based on a specific theme, and the theme for the current edition is the state of readiness of the public service for 2010 and beyond. And on the right-hand side, you see the nine constitutional values and principles, which we use as our lens to assess the public service. And we use this now against the theme of 2010. In terms of a high standard of professional ethics, one notes that the hosting of the World Cup involves a lot of resources, and it is important that there's a professional public service which does not tolerate corruption and inspires public confidence. This cannot be overemphasized. Now, based on its oversight work, the PSE believes that critical areas for improvement include the management of misconduct. We found that cases take too long and sanctions are inconsistent. Financial disclosures was at 80% compliance rate in 2007 and 8. Responding to cases from the National Anti-Corruption Hotline, which dropped to 12.4% in the 7-8 cycle, and issues around supply chain management. Now, an effective anti-corruption partnership between government, business, and civil society is key, and the National Anti-Corruption Forum should be leveraged for this purpose. As far as the second principle goes, which is the efficient, economic, and effective use of resources, there will be an additional service demand given the envisaged influx of forced tourists, but public value and service delivery must not be compromised. Areas of attention include improving the quality and credibility of travel documents, queue management at ports of entry, boosting capacity at police stations in host cities, improving emergency medical services, and addressing the skills of public servants, including issues of soft skills. The country should not lose focus on building institutional capacity to promote development. As far as the public administration needing to be development-oriented, successes were noted in reducing the proportion of people living below the poverty line. However, much of the progress has ridden on the back of favorable economic growth. Hosting the World Cup should be used as an opportunity to support job creation, infrastructure development, and the development of skills for project planning and implementation. And the public service needs to develop a deeper appreciation of its role in development and poverty reduction. Provision of services in an impartial, fair, and equitable manner. The event will be scrutinized to see whether it opens up opportunities fairly and equitably. Focus should not just be on achieving fairness, but also on being seen to be fair. Perceptions are important, as experiences from the recent xenophobic attacks point out. Also, access to opportunities are not enough on its own for redress. It is important to also promote the use of these opportunities. The implementation of the PAJA is still inadequate, and there's no reason for performance in this area to remain unsatisfactory as it does. People's needs need to be responded to, and the public must participate in policy making. Now, preparations for the 2010 event have involved encouraging examples of citizen participation. They should serve as lessons for the public service. Efforts by the executive to connect with citizens is in Bezos have been noted, but these can be deepened. And the report notes that one needs to move beyond the engagement at an executive level. It also needs to happen at a departmental level. The report also notes that it's important to resist sacrificing public participation at the altar of managerial freedom. The point being made that management of departments must engage with citizens and not leave them out of the loop of decision-making. And it also argues that some of the crisis and issues that we see right now is linked to the fact that there hasn't been adequate connection between departments and citizens themselves. The development of skills to promote public participation is still not receiving adequate attention, and in this process, citizens should be treated with courtesy to feel that their views are valued. As far as the issue of accountability goes, the report notes that despite the many accountability mechanisms that are in place, compliance is still not optimal. Performance agreements are a key accountability mechanism, but compliance remains unsatisfactory. Even more concerning is that performance incentives are sometimes awarded without a performance appraisal. And in the report, we cite an example of that, where in a province, performance bonuses were awarded without the processes being followed. The existence of qualified audit opinions also remain a cause for concern, especially considering departments that are key for the 2010 event. And we cite quite extensively from the report in terms of the number of departments that were audited, I think 120, and only 4 of those departments actually received clean audits. And then we go more specifically to those departments that are key to this event and show that many of them have also received a qualified audit, which is a concern. Other critical areas include internal financial controls, risk management, fraud prevention, and capacity to investigate fraud. In this report, when you go through, you'll find that we cite extensively our other work. Example, the transversal public service M&E system, where when we look at a set of departments, like we looked at over 15 last year and currently 30 departments, we go in and in detail, we're able to talk about and rate the assessment in terms of all these areas. Another area that's quite critical is the fostering transparency by providing timely, accessible, and accurate information. Now, we know that the World Cup and its opportunities have been widely advertised through various media, and there are pockets of excellence regarding the basic principle of information. But the promotion of the Access to Information Act seeks to foster transparency, but adherence remains unsatisfactory. And here we cite the work of the South African Human Rights Commission and the lack of compliance by departments in terms of ensuring that basic requirements are met. And there's a lot of statistical analysis in the report. System for managing requests for information is still inadequate. We note in the report that it is quite fundamental that departments not only acknowledge receipt of requests, but also act on them. So that the whole question of a transparent and accessible public service is not at the level of rhetoric, but also operates in reality. The possibility of language as an information barrier is raised. We raise it more specifically in our individual report, and we have pointed this out in a great amount of detail. However, there are enough good practices around for departments to learn from. When it comes to good human resource management and career development practices, and the need for these to be cultivated, the 2010 related pressures should not lead to unaccountable human resource management practices. Consistency in the application of norms and standards remains a challenge, and we speak about various norms and standards, from recruitment and selection to assessments, etc. We find that workplace skills plans are still weak at the aggregate level and at the departmental level. And this may account for the fact that the capacity in departments has not improved significantly over time. Filling of posts takes too long, and some departments are unable to complete the human resource plan. As far as filling of posts goes, we note that the norm of 90 days is 3 months in place, but many departments take as long as 200 days to fill a post. And the question that we ask is the implications of this for service delivery, because when the posts are not filled, someone else is picking up the work that needs to be done. Strengthening human resource components remains a priority to address these challenges. Finally, that public administration must be broadly representative of the South African people. The World Cup is an opportunity to showcase the diversity of the country. Most of the targets of the public service have been met, but gender and disability remain a challenge, and you'll find tables that actually indicate the nature of this challenge. So whilst we have the policies in place as far as disability goals of 2% and gender, the 50-50, these have obviously not been met as the report indicates. But apart from addressing numeric targets, attention must be paid to addressing the whole question of diversity management, which should include greater gender and disability sensitivity. And more guidance can be provided on this by the Department of Labour and Public Service and Administration. In conclusion, the public service should take advantage of hosting of the World Cup to bolster its capacity to be responsive, effective and efficient. This event has injected substantial resources which can be leveraged to strengthen public administration, not only for 2010, but the period beyond. And it will be crucial to address many of the recurring challenges that have continued to impact negatively on the performance scorecard for public service. What I have done, honourable members, is gone through a 60-page report in a few slides, but we have sent the report out so you've had a chance to actually engage with it. And I thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just perhaps to emphasize, because I think as Indran has just said, that for this edition of the State of the Public Service, we chose the theme of readiness of the public service for 2010. I think it's important to emphasize that the reason why we chose this theme is really twofold. The one reason was the amount of resources that are being allocated for this event, which it is hoped that they can be leveraged, these resources can be leveraged for a socio-economic development over the long term. So that's the one reason. Early as August 2008, for instance, there was 8.4 billion rand that was allocated for the building of the stadium and about 9 billion for transport. And these resources, of course, have escalated since then. So the question is really how to leverage these resources that are also including safety and security, so that they can be for the development in the long term. The second aspect I think that's important to emphasize is that this occasion also gives us an opportunity to showcase our Batubile philosophy. In other words, how do we take care of our visitors? How do we sharpen up our service delivery points so that we are able to treat people with courtesy, we are able to meet the targets that we have outlined for ourselves in order to have the proper service delivery. So these are the really main reasons that we chose this. Now, over the years, we have produced the State of the Public Service in order to give, if you like, an assessment of the public service for a particular year. These reports have improved over the years, and one of the reasons why they improve is the work that we do, because they are based on the work that is done by the Commission and other entities. But also why they continue to improve is that we take them through processes like the round table, where we invite academics, we invite interested people, the public servants themselves, to sit and critique each one of the reports. And that we have done for this report as well. During those roundtable discussions, we get to learn what is envisaged by these stakeholders and what elements or aspects of the report we should be improving. So we're quite impressed, and there's been a lot of talk about this report over the years. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for the report. Honourable members, if there's anything you want to raise on the report, you are free to do that interaction. Okay. I can see the... Okay. Honourable from South Bay.
Thank you, Chair. Regarding the principle of professional ethics, just in yesterday's newspapers, we saw the report of the CETA corruption, the acting CEO of CETA acknowledged at the GovTech conference that a lot of corruption and fraud we find it at CETA. Are you aware of that? Can you give us any more information? Of course, there were a lot of people from abroad attending the conference, and it was revealed there at the conference, which is not so good for the public service. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Sanders-Wake and Honourable Solomon.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The National Anti-Corruption Hotline, in your booklet you mentioned that it went in the financial year 2007-2018, then the report back went down to 12.4%. What is the main reason for that? Because you mentioned there that the success of this is largely dependent on the extent to which feedback to callers is provided. Now, presently, we also got this presidential hotline. How will it complement this National Anti-Corruption Hotline? Who will be investigating the cases or complaints reported to the presidential hotline launched recently? Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable members, any other issue to raise, or can I just give a chance to the Public Service Commission to respond? We'll come back to issues thereafter. Would you like to take them?
The first question pertaining to CETA, I personally haven't, but maybe the minister will deal with that, because we are not associated with that. The report is really based on work that we have done, the investigation, the monitoring and evaluation reports that we undertook in the previous financial year. The second question about the presidential hotline. Firstly, the reason why there is a low feedback on the cases that are reported there. We have attributed this mainly to the fact that departments don't have the capacity to investigate these cases. People complain on the hotline, we take those complaints, we refer them to departments by and large, and the departments are supposed to investigate those and come back to us. Some do. The response rate is quite low, as indicated in the report. The Public Service Commission does also select a number of high-profile cases during this report and does investigate those cases. If it was up to the Public Service Commission, we would investigate most of the cases, but there are capacity problems within the Public Service Commission. There are guidelines that have been given to departments on how to strengthen their capacity for investigation, or at least how they would have to do that, but I guess that they do also face capacity problems. Now, the presidential hotline, before its inception, the Public Service Commission did write a report to the President outlining our national anti-corruption hotline and outlining the problems and the areas that need to be strengthened. And it is hoped that we will be meeting as soon as now, after a month or two, that the presidential hotline has been in the process, because you will recognize that the number of cases, the cases that we get, are also cases that are related to corruption and service delivery. So that interaction will be very crucial, and we did in our report indicate that we would need to engage. Now, the second question is, how will those cases from there be treated? As we understand it, is that those cases are also taken care of by liaison people within each one of the departments. In each department, there is a liaison person who is able to take the complaints from the hotline of the presidency and be able to process them. And I can second guess that, again, the problem there would be how those departments' capacity is. That will influence whether the success rate of investigation is. So I think these are the areas that need a lot of attention by government and by departments as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Let me just attempt to address the first question that was raised by Honourable Dre, is it? Okay. Let me firstly say that compliments to the committee. You've done the first step, which is occupy the seats of cabinet. So we just need to make the authority legal. I think that you perhaps might have misunderstood the media report on this matter. It is true that the matter was discussed at the GovTech conference, and it was placed at the conference at the behest of the CEO. But I think you would be incorrectly understanding the media report if you were to interpret that to mean that the CEO has made admission that there is corruption within CETA. That would be an incorrect reading of what actually happened. What the CEO dealt with in his address to the GovTech conference was to put into the plenary discussion a whole range of considerations which were identified as challenges that Sita was facing in terms of its desire to evolve a strategy to revitalize its operation. And one of the challenges that it raised was the widespread perception, largely driven by the media, that there is widespread corruption in Sita processes. And I thought what he did was a very bold and very daring initiative, in that he raised the matter himself in a gathering of about 2,000 delegates by way of a presentation. And in that presentation, he gave an analysis of this perception. And Sita had undertaken a survey of a whole range of stakeholders to illustrate where this perception was actually arising from. And amongst the things that he identified is that a large measure of the perception has its roots amongst industry players themselves, and largely players who have lost in tenders or bids and who obviously are party to what might be a kind of internal network of information circulation that happens in the industry. And the thrust of his presentation was to put on the table the understanding that so long as we don't deal with this perception decisively, it will continue to surface to harm and injure the way Sita operates. It damages the credibility of Sita, it creates a negative perception amongst industry players, and it in a sense creates this continuous doubt that Sita itself finds difficult to deal with, that there are these problems in its adjudication processes. So, after having said all of that in the presentation and sharing the results of this perception survey that he did, he then engaged the audience on a whole range of questions, and they've had these sort of electronic monitors by which they could respond to these questions. And what was very revealing was that amongst the questions that he canvassed on the spot in that presentation was A, what percentage of the industry players who were present in the gathering really believe that this perception is true? So everybody pressed the button and on the screen the results flashed up. And you found that 58% of the audience present believed that this perception is true. Then another question he asked was, what percentage of the audience present is willing to openly disclose information about corruption in Sita? And in response to that, only 32% said that they were willing. The rest of them said that they were not willing. So in that way, he built the responses organically in the conference to the general question as to what should we collectively do, both industry and the organization, to deal with this thing. And his pleading was that if there is evidence and information that corruption is present in the procedures of Sita, the invitation is thrown open for those people who have the information to use the hotline in the department and to disclose that information with the greatest degree of immunity. So that was the invitation that he threw out. Secondly, he invited the industry to assist in the process of having to combat this perception, because in terms of the management processes, and then he outlined the internal procedures in Sita that have been instituted at the management level to deal with some of these things. And that was the presentation. And I think what happened in the media was a report of it. I didn't see the media report, but it may well be that the media might have conveyed a different sort of thing that actually happened. So what I'm trying to correct is that the Sita CEO didn't make an admission. He was dealing with what he saw as challenges in the operating environment, and invited the audience on how to deal with it arising from this perception study. On the second question, the anti-corruption hotline of the president, if I may just comment on that one, because I participated in one meeting where this project was discussed. And of course, CETA provides the backbone to the project. It's a project which is led by a presidential team. And I think the project is seen in the context of the president's statement in the presidential debate and in the inauguration speech, where he makes the comment that what we really want to do is to design a government which must be seen by the people to be more responsive, more caring, more concerning, and more engaging on the matters that concern people. And the presidential hotline was conceived as a mechanism to give people direct access to the highest office in the land, to raise the issues that are concerning them, primarily on service delivery, on maltreatment by public servants, and observations or perceptions or information they may have of corruption, or on officials or political office bearers that they may consider to require some measure of attention. And that is the key instrument. Now, the second thing that was recognized was that the project itself seems to have won considerable support from all levels of government. The premiers are wanting to set similar hotlines in their provinces, and departments are keen to participate in responding to the queries that are coming through the hotline. The third principle that appears to be emerging in the way the project is being structured is that it is not intended to convey the impression that the president's office is going to act to remove any service delivery blockages or whatever. The president's office at the moment will be a conduit of the information. But the active service points to correct the deficiencies must be the respective departments. So it is intended that in the departments there will be liaison officers who will work with about 43 liaison officers that have been established in this hotline in the presidency staff who are taking calls, and there will be a mechanism worked out with the liaison officers in the department units which would in time be attached to service delivery improvement units in the department. And what the presidential project will then look at is how to ensure that there is a proper tracking system of these complaints, there is a proper reporting on follow-up action that is being taken by the department, and that there is some measure of accountability even to the callers over a period of time. From the reports that we've seen, that in the first few hours or so, there were a number, I think over about 7,000 calls were made. But of course the disturbing thing about it, or not the disturbing, the worrying thing about it, is that there's a very high percentage of prank calls and really dropped calls. And this was a feature that is also a characteristic feature of the existing hotline. So I think it's just an ongoing issue that we need to address as we develop the project. But the project is still in its very early days. We will really need to make sure that the back office operation that supports this is really strengthened, that we don't fail on the technology side. But I think the formal launch of the project will come at a later date. There's a bit of an informal launch right now and announcement. And I think the number is 17737. Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. and Dr. Mkijima. There was still a hand from Honorable Sam Selfwake. I don't know whether you wanted to follow up. Okay, if you're in the room, would you still want to?
Sorry, I would like to follow up. Deputy Minister, thank you for the response. The newspapers did not reflect the correct information in connection with the presentation then, for they said that the CEO acknowledged. I was just going to ask you, sir, where do we as committee members get the correct information in connection with the presentation? Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Francis. I'll take Honourable Dreyer, followed by Honourable Rasool, and then Honourable Malulege will come after. Honourable Dreyer.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you very much. Through you, I actually want to thank Dr. Mkijima for his presentation. Once again, we've seen you and your commission a couple of times already, and we get your regular reports, which we appreciate very much. It's really useful information and tools for us, giving us the ammunition, but it's then over to us to use. When we got this one that you presented today a couple of weeks ago, it was already distributed, and I read it, my first thought, but I've read it before, haven't I? I thought, no, I haven't read this one before because it was a new one, so obviously I haven't read it before. But I think the reason I thought that is because the information in here is kind of highlights the recurrence of problems, that you, the things you tell us in report after report after report. And I think you're very creative. You try and color it in or in different, using different mechanisms. This time you use the theme of readiness for the 2010 World Cup, which is very creative. But what is worrying is that it highlights to us that there are serial offenders and there are problems that are recurring year after year after year. I mean, what we see here is it's not new. The problem of vacancies, it exists. It's not a new thing. It's existed for years. The problem of signing key performance agreements by the senior managers. You highlighted once again, we've been aware of that for some time. The declaration of financial interest, the levels of corruption, and so on. The things that come out here are not new to us. So you highlighted to us once again. But what it tells us is, as a committee, then, Madam Deputy, Madam Chairperson, it's really for us as a committee to. The information given to us, for us now to act on it. Because the problem is, we know what the problem is. The challenge is to implement the proposed measures, to implement the solutions, to make things right. We know where things are going wrong, we've now got to make it right, and that's the problem. And I'm glad the Deputy Minister is here as well, because it becomes then in the field of government, they must make sure the ministers, the executives, that they correct the shortcomings that exist. Madam Deputy, you made a reference to the motion that we debated, or the debate that we had in the National Assembly a couple of weeks ago, and that's the kind of thing we should do more often, I think. Our voices as a committee, we must let our voices be heard more vigorously, because we know what the problem is. The Public Service Commission does an excellent job, but it's over to government to implement. That's really the key word, implementation. It's more plea, it's not a question, it's more plea from our side. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Dreyer, Honourable Rasool.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Just a few questions. I think that while Honourable Dreyer mentions the theme that goes to it, like World Cup 2010 and so forth, where it doesn't create, it's just an aside question, doesn't create the wrong impression that we're doing a whole lot of things for 2010, as opposed to doing it because we love democracy and we love transparency and all of those kind of things, that we're doing it only because the world is watching us. I just think that it may be an unintended consequence of it. I think it's a theme that I have been speaking about in other discussions with the PSC, but
I think that issues, for example, around financial disclosure, we are now reaching 80% and 90% of compliance with it. The question is, does the PSC have the wherewithal to take that to another level? To really, because we've made compliance the main indicator, but I think that the key thing is what you do now that you, when you have now 100% of financial disclosures, how do you analyze them? What do you do with them? How do you verify them? How do you check them out? Because financial disclosures by themselves can't be a fetish. You've got to be able now to do something with it and ease the machinery there to do it. I think in much the same, way, other indicators are becoming almost obsolete, like over and under expenditure as the measure of performance of government. I think you're getting close to a variation of about 3% to either way, over expenditure, under expenditure. I think that once you've reached the magical north, we're very clear now that the challenge is the quality of spending. Because in pushing for no under expenditure, you may be encouraging wasteful expenditure. So how do you move on to a new measure that begins, and I'm anticipating this because I think that this will be the 2010 challenge. You can't come in 2010 and say the same kind of thing and say 100% now, 100% north variation on over and under expenditure. I think one has to prepare for that. I think in so those are key things. The third issue I wanted to raise is the issue which you begin to problematize in public participation. Again, if you look at the fact that South Africa is rated 150th least friendly country to do business with, how do you manage the tension between elaborate public participation processes and decision making? The ability to for a government to govern. So is there room that the Public Service Commission could recommend how do you overcome vested interests who know that they only have to work the system in order to scare off an investor, discourage a development, or whatever the case may be. So that how do you make public participation the domain of the citizen and not of the vested interest? And I think that that becomes a major challenge because people who have fairly unobstructed views, who built their houses in wildernesses, are the greatest believers in environment. At this point, how do we balance out some of those things? And then the last thing, which is also for the Honorable Dreyer to pick up on, how does the Public Service Commission in monitoring representativity in the public service, for example, in the Western Cape, ensure that where you've had a hard-won 20% representation of Africans, that you don't go back to the starting point of 8%. 30% representation of women, that you don't go back. 0.3% representation of disability, that you don't fall back on those things. So do you how do you engage to protect gains that have been made? Those are the four issues that I thought I wanted to raise.
Yes,
Honorable
Russell, I think, you know, in line with what Honorable Russell, before I come to you, Honorable Malule, I'm sure quite clearly in terms of Section 195 of the Constitution, where it talks of the monitoring and the evaluation of the implementation that the public service also has to assist us with, you know, when we realize the report talks of, you know, it focuses on the different departments' activities, you know, so what one has to really ask, particularly from yourself and the presentation, is that how then does the public service track the progress of the implementation? And I think that is in line with the question that Honorable Russell is raising, you know, in terms of the improvements, the recommendation made in previous reports, which becomes very critical. I'm just following up on that. And then maybe let me take Honorable Maluleka, and then I'll hand over to the Public Service Commission.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the efficient, economic, and effective use of resources, last paragraph, they said the country should not lose focus on building institutional capacity to promote development. As reported that the four provincial departments of sports and recreation have underspent to the tune of 40 million towards infrastructure readiness for World Cup 2010. What do you think the National Department and the relevant committee should do to address the problem?
Yes, Dr. Mkitim.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think once more the comments that are being made are very valid ones. And I think for the Public Service Commission, as we did discuss in the last meeting, the Public Service Commission is taking the comments very, very seriously indeed, especially the comments that come from Member Rasool, where we did in the last engagement talk about how to take the monitoring and evaluation to the next level, the monitoring and evaluation of the Public Service Commission. There are different scenarios, and I think one problem that also arises from the comments of Member Dreyer is the problems of capacity. And that capacity, you know, both in terms of the Public Service Commission and in terms of government in general, but in terms of the Public Service Commission, for instance, when it comes to this area of financial disclosure, is that we are dealing with a very large public service. And we have begun, as we did indicate last time, that we are engaging in this area, and the idea is not really that of compliance alone. The idea is really to ensure that one prevents the possibilities of potential conflicts of interest. In other words, people need to be counseled. So it is that capacity that we are unleashing at the level of heads of departments and directors general. But the question may well be asked, what happens at the lower level? Because there is now recommendations that this must be taken to the lower levels of the public service. So those questions of capacity remain indeed a problem that need to be looked at. Compliance is improving in some areas, Member Rasool, but in some areas it isn't. Clearly, it's hopeless in some areas. So I think that we shouldn't sacrifice the search for compliance, really. I think we should emphasize it, but recognize the need to take this to a much higher level. And what, as I said, what I read in the comments, both in the area of financial disclosures, the over and under expenditure, insofar as saying, but what is the quality of that expenditure? And also of saying, how do you improve that? And how do you see the contradictions between our democracy and its public participatory methodology and our desire to be ranked a bit higher in terms of getting the investment? Are areas that I think the Public Service Commission is noting as areas that we need to be looking into in our future work plan. And I think that this is what I read from these comments. I will leave to Mr. Indra Naidu the questions that arise on our monitoring and evaluation system. How does it track, Madam Chair, how does it track the progress that the public service is making in these areas that we're monitoring and evaluation from year to year? Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Naidu.
Thank you, Chairperson. In terms of the question that was asked around compliance by Honorable Russell, that you've got an 80% compliance, what after we reach 100%, what happens? We do actually probe further. We do look at, and the report indicates that potential conflict of interest range from 45 to 72%. Now, this is potential, not actual, and that could vary. But over and above that, when we scrutinize these financial disclosure forms, we also run searches against the other databases. So you're able to see other properties, etc. And if you remember, towards the latter part of last year and then early this year, the report that emerged from the Auditor General on the question of public officials holding directorships, and that was actually based on the initial research that the PSC itself had done. And in our report itself, if you look at the footnotes, that actually points to the actual report and the actual reports where that had taken place. In terms of the question of what happens, now there's two levels at which we look at it. We, on an annual basis, track the implementation of recommendations. So we're able to count how many recommendations we make. But of course, we're still improving the quality of recommendations to make them more time-bound, because some of it is advice, etc. And we're able to indicate for the various types of recommendations the extent to which the departments have got back to us. And if they have not, why, that has been the case. And that was a question that was asked previously of the portfolio committee. And I think as we go forward, it's a discussion and a debate on its own, so that you would actually be able to see exactly which departments repeatedly do not uptake the recommendations of PSC. The third part of that is our transversal public service M&E system. We have now reached 101 departments, which we have covered across the country. And in this year's cycle, the 30 departments that we are doing this year, there's 4 departments that we are doing for the second time. And in that report, we have pointed out the recommendations that we previously issued and how many have been implemented. And we found at that level that the uptake has not been good. So very shortly, when the consolidated M&E report is released, you'll find it to be quite a different consolidated report. Not only will it show trends from 2000 to present, but it will also show, we classify departments into 3 areas. One, those departments that we have revisited, and to see whether they have improved, your point of all the recommendations about what has happened. The second category, those departments that have met the standards. In other words, they comply 60% and above for the 9 principles. And the third category, those that are unacceptable performers. And we actually name all these departments for each of the principles. So, you know, that will come out. And I think that will actually move from this fairly high-level report to the actual detail of what is going on in terms of the governance of departments themselves.
Honourable members, I'm not sure if there's still anything that we really want to raise. Yes, we can follow up on
the Western Cape could say how they would safeguard the gains that have been made in terms of representativity and monitoring.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the provincial government in the Western Cape, who is the custodian to ensure that posts are filled in line with representativity targets, etc. From my perspective, if I look at the M&E that we've conducted in the department, there's been a definite increase, as you rightfully point out. But I think the challenge in terms of protecting that, we have experienced from departments the high turnover rates as far as the appointment of blacks are concerned. And then in terms of disability, even though there has been a great improvement in people with disabilities being appointed, there's the challenge of people not wanting to disclose their status. So even though a department might say that we have 1.7% people disabled on the establishment, in reality it's actually more than that. But because people refuse to disclose, it won't show up on the stats. But there definitely has been an improvement, and I think that improvement is quite static.
No. Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Interesting that people don't always want to disclose their status in terms of disability. There's a sensitivity around it, and maybe if you've got nothing to do with anybody else, you want it's private, confidential. But I also want to ask, what about disclosing kind of race? Have you found that there's an unwillingness also in certain cases for some people to disclose the race? And if so, how do you manage that?
Well, unfortunately, we haven't picked up any unwillingness in terms of disclosing race, because in all instances where we've done assessments, people's race has been classified.
For the Honourable Dreyer's information, that the previous system had three digits at the end, which whether you disclosed or not, it says what your race is.
Madam Chair, on that point, if I may, that was my point. I'm glad Member Rafool took it further, and we no longer have that three digits making that distinction. So, and there's no law also on race classification to tell you what are the requirements that you have to comply with in order to be classified as this, that, or the other. In other words, the only way you can put down a race classification on an official form is by voluntary association. If I come up to you and say, I'm a coloured South African, you have to accept that. And you can't disagree or argue with me, because on what basis will you do that? So that's completely my point is, race classification is a completely voluntary identification. There's no official or legal basis for race classification in this country. And if people don't want to disclose, they say they belong to the human race, for example, which I believe I do. I belong to this one race, and that's the human race, and that's what I will put down. Or people can say any race that they want to. You can't argue with them. There's no legal basis.
Thank you. Chair, I would just like to ask Minister Parayachi, where can I get the correct information, please? I think that we as committee members should know what the correct situation is.
No, I think that's quite true. Maybe the easiest route would be to write a letter to the CEO asking him for a copy of the presentation that he did at the conference. I'm sure that's quite available.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'm not addressing this question. I'm proceeding, Madam Chair. That's fine. On another area. I just thought that it would be important for me to just recap where we are from our previous meeting. That the interaction with the committee has gone very well, I think, in terms of especially the first two values and principles of public service administration. And those are the areas of ethics, which we have been debating quite a lot, and the second principle of efficiency, economic and effective use of resources. I think those principles, we have gone into them in our discussion quite a lot. The rest of the principles, I think that there are a number of reports and work that the Public Service Commission has done in as well. We're looking at development orientation of the public service, where we look at poverty. There's a lot that the Commission has done there in terms of dialogues on poverty, I think, which we did indicate to you last time, and also the area of human resources. There's a lot of work that the Commission has done there as well. The provision of services impartially and fair, public participation, I think we did touch on today, but clearly it's an area that we need also to look at, accountability, transparency, and again we touched on representativity. So there is quite a number of reports that also will be coming up from the Public Service Commission side for us, giving us room to look at those as well. The second point that I would like to make is that these interactions have and are continuing to enrich the work plan of the Public Service Commission in terms of what other areas do we need to be doing research on as we proceed. The last, unfinished business is around the area of the recommendations. I think that in the last meeting, Madam Chair, that we spoke, we discussed, we explored, and we thought we would leave it for the future. This area of recommendations in terms of how the committee, you know, deals with recommendations, what quality, I think it was Indran who just indicated how, you know, perhaps the quality of the recommendations that the Public Service Commission channels out needs to improve, but having improved in terms of what you are saying, in terms of targets and dates and everything, how do we ourselves and the committee ensure that we are able to monitor and evaluate those recommendations? As I said, indicated in the last meeting, we do track them. We are beginning to have a master plan of all the recommendations that we have made, and we will continue to do that. But I think the bigger question still remains in terms of how we take those further from the committee side. But we also did get a very good input from the minister in the last interaction that we had, in terms of how, from the executive side, there is a commitment to ensure that the recommendations are taken. But thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you to the Public Service Commission, and Mr. Naidu and Ma'am Julie. Thanks for the presentation, and Dr. Mgijima. Just to reflect, I want to also thank the Deputy Minister for his contribution on the issue of anti-corruption, and indicate that in our previous meeting, when we were with the Public Service Commission and the Department, we did also reflect that our follow-up with the Department would be on the issue of the one that we'll be addressing today, of our class approach in terms of interaction. Moving forward, and we also talked about this anti-corruption. And I must indicate that we did say in follow-up, those are the things that we'll be looking at with the department. We know for a fact that they had been on top of the agenda of the anti-corruption issues as a department. For an example, there are a number of other things that also contributing to this as part of a nation that will show that we will be under all odds against any kind of corruption. There is a hotline that we saw, we also launched by the President yesterday, that also focuses on the issue of anti-corruption. There was also the address, I'm sure it's in follow-up with the State of the Nation address by the President in terms of that hotline. Then it's implemented, we've seen that it's happening. The Department of Public Service and Administration has been, interacting in international platform on this matter. There had been provincial involvement at some point, there had been businesses. But we didn't want to see those efforts being consolidated at some point. And I'm sure the Public Service Commission will be more concerned to bring this issue, what happens thereafter. You know, many citizens in this country have already raised these issues, have raised some strategies that they've been thinking about, you know, where they want to partner with government, and we think we need to look into all those efforts, integrate them, but we really, at some point, as this committee, want to see the department leading in terms of the integrated approach on that area. And I'm glad that you have already started to discuss specifics. I actually wanted to just hint this, and I can see the Deputy Minister's hand is up. After the Deputy Minister, we will just hint the way forward.
No, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I just wanted to remind the committee of one point which I think is important that has a bearing on this conversation that was raised in the workshop that we had as a portfolio committee. And I think it was a point that was made by a previous public service commissioner when he raised the need for us to interrogate the rules of parliament and the way committees function. And he raised it in the context that this committee ought to consider making representations on transforming the rules of parliament in the way committees work, so that it enables this committee to have a stronger oversight capability when it needs to respond to the public service recommendations vis-a-vis the state of the public service in respect of departments. Because right now it seems the only committee that has that kind of capability is COPA, to call departments to get them to account. Yet this committee has got a transversal responsibility to ensure that the public service functions. But the way the committee functions, you only have the portfolio structures within the Department of Public Service that accounts to it. And maybe it needs a bit of exploration and more sort of deeper discussion. I thought we shouldn't lose that point. It was a good point that came out in the workshop. I thought I'll remind you of that. Thank you.
Okay, yes, thank you, Deputy Minister. I'm sure the committee members, I mean the members will agree with me that part of why we start to talk of a cluster approach is because of that. And I'm sure, I know the minister was out of the country when there was this debate about this report, which was introduced by Honorable Judith Breyer. How we actually approached that debate, it was COPA together with the Auditor General and the committee itself. So meaning that not only talking about it, the realization is now starting to be implemented in that kind of a direction. I really appreciate that, and that's the direction we're going to take. So our follow-up in terms of setting the cluster is part of integrating that. And of course, in future, you'll be seeing us, particularly chairperson of various committees and other committees, starting to work together in an integrated way, and we really appreciate that. We will engage more on such, because that's how we're going to be able to work better. Can I then allow that we have a 10-minute break to get tea and immediately come back so that we proceed with a Department of Public Service and Administration presentation? Thank you very much. Have to proceed. We are now remaining only 40 minutes. Okay, we'll wait a bit. Thanks again. We will be proceeding. Something that I did not do when we started, but maybe because many more apologies came in while we already started. I'm sure it's important and very critical for me to just do an apology for other chairpersons who intended joining us in this session, but who could not make it at the end. We do have an apology from Honorable Patekile Holomisa, who is coordinating the Joint Committee on Constitutional Review. The other apology was from Honorable Trebejani, who is actually coordinating the Private Members Legislative Proposal and Special Petition. The other apology is from Barbara Thompson. Barbara is the Chairperson for Women, Youth, Children and People with Disabilities. The last or two other politicians. The other one was from Honorable Godi, who is in the public account. And then the last one was, Honorable Godi, who is in SCOPA. The last one was from Honorable Mike Masuta, who is the chairperson for the Auditor General Committee. So those are the apologies we just happened to have a lot of clashes, but I must indicate all the chairpersons intended to be part of this meeting today, and we just couldn't make it because of other circumstances and other urgent matters that just came before them. So I'm sure it would have
been... Madam Chair, on that illustrious list, may I add the Honourable Minister Baloyi?
Yes, you know, that's true. Actually, we also got a formal apology from the Minister because he's attending the GovTech. Yes, also the minister who intended and wished to be part of this meeting quite seriously. So we believe the next round will try to look around the schedule as well so that we can have all of them being part of this meeting. Thanks for reminding me, Deputy Minister. I'm going to hand over to Richard, not Richard Baloyi in this case. Dr. Richard Lavin to actually take us through the presentation. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Deputy Minister, Honourable Members. Thank you for this opportunity to talk to the Governance and Administration Cluster. What I'll be doing in the presentation is to provide some background which will talk to the evolution of the cluster system, how it's structured, how it's organized, and then move into an overview of the program of action, and then just give an indication of the timelines for reporting, and from there we'll close off the presentation. Now, in order to understand the cluster system, we need to go back to the Presidential Review Commission of 1998, which made an observation which I think most review commissions of this nature would tend to make globally, and that is that the coordination between government departments is a major challenge. The report also spoke about the need to strengthen the center of government and the role which the center of government needs to play in coordinating different elements of the system in order to achieve the various objectives which government sets for itself. So that in a nutshell is really the motivation for the establishment of the cluster system, which occurred in 1999. And really consisted of cabinet committees, ministerial clusters, and DG clusters. But in 2004, there was the introduction of programs of action, which required clusters to establish programs in their areas of competence and then report to cabinet committees on a regular basis. And ultimately, it's become a very public, open, and transparent process. And I think at the end, we'll look at what that means and what it would mean as well for Parliament and this committee. Now, in terms of the cabinet substructures, we have cabinet committees, which are chaired by the President or the Deputy President. And these meet fortnightly and make recommendations to cabinet, which then considers the recommendations and takes decisions. We also have the ministerial clusters, and these are chaired by cluster coordinating ministers. And in those meetings, cluster ministers and DGs are invited. And those cluster meetings really focus on preparatory work, which would be, for example, for Cabinet Makotla, or it may be around reports which are being prepared on the program of action. So basically, if we look at the structure of the cabinet committees in the current office of government, we have the cabinet committee of the social sectors, community and human development, the cabinet committee on the economic sectors, employment and infrastructure development, the cabinet committee on governance and administration, the cabinet committee on justice, crime prevention, peace and security, and the cabinet committee on international cooperation, trade and security. So that's the structure of the cabinet committees. Then looking at the DG structures which support these various structures and provide technical inputs to them, we have the Forum of South African Directors General, which is chaired by the Director General in the Presidency, and which also incorporates all national and provincial DGs as well as the CEO of SALDA. Then we have a management committee for FOSAD, which consists of the DG and the presidency as the chairperson and the various chairs of the different clusters. The DG clusters themselves are co-chaired by the DGs of lead departments, and this is illustrated on the next page where we have a indication of the different DG clusters and the various coordinating departments. So these are listed: infrastructure development, economic sectors, human development, social protection, community development, governance administration, which is co-chaired by the DG of public service and administration and the DG of cooperative governance and traditional affairs. And then we have the justice, crime prevention and security, and international cooperation, trade and security. So I think these slides give us a clear indication of the cluster system and its structure. The next slide tries to talk to the way in which the role of clusters has evolved. So initially, there was very much purely a focus on harmonizing the work of departments in terms of strategy, policy, and implementation in order to reduce the kind of turf divisions which exist within the administration between different departments, institutions, and so on, and the tendency for different elements of the administration to work in silos and not to cooperate and to protect what departments may perceive as their domain of work. But post-2004, as indicated, the role of clusters has evolved to producing reports on the implementation of the program of action. And the idea is to generate an atmosphere and a practice as well of peer group pressure, a culture of collective leadership for implementation of the program of action, and as well as also to actually coordinate the implementation of the program of action to ensure that departmental resources are allocated for the implementation of projects within the program of action, and also then to identify where there are blockages and where there are key areas which are priority areas which don't appear to be acted upon. Now, the cluster meets on a monthly basis, the DG cluster, for 4 hours, and in between that we have a working session. The members of the cluster include the co-chairs, the DPSA and Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, the Presidency, National Treasury, the Department of Women, Children and Persons with Disabilities, Statistics South Africa, GCIS, Office of the Public Service Commission, Justice and Constitutional Development, various line departments. Provincial DGs are members of the Governance and Administration cluster. Of course, they are permitted to attend other cluster meetings, but formally they participate in the Governance and Administration cluster. On our agendas, we take briefings on matters emanating from cabinet and matters emanating from the FOSAD Manco and FOSAD more broadly. Then we look at reports and presentations on strategic issues in governance and administration, the majority of which would be part of the program of action activities. The Secretariat also is based in the DPSA and Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, and we have to coordinate the meetings and the work on the program of action. Now, the program of action really in all the clusters derives from the medium-term strategic framework, which is developed based on the electoral mandate and has 10 strategic priorities. The priority which is most relevant and which we use as the overarching theme for the GNA cluster is priority number 10, which is building a developmental state, including improvement of public services and strengthening democratic institutions. Within this strategic priority, there are four objectives: improve the capability of the center of government for strategic leadership and to further strengthen the capacity of the public service to meet its obligations of serving citizens, to substantially improve the delivery and quality of public services, to entrench a culture and practice of transparent, honest, and accountable public service, and to strengthen the engagement with society, promote the integrity and legitimacy of constitutional bodies, and to strengthen democratic institutions. So these are the objectives which we use to guide us in the development of the program. The program, as I've indicated, is derived from the MTSF priorities. And what we've really tried very hard in this particular program of action is to ensure that we generate maximum participation from all departments in the cluster and to ensure this integration by giving responsibility to groups of departments that have competence in a particular area. But always we need to have a lead department, because at the end of the day there always has to be some level of accountability. So what the presentation now does, it takes each one of those objectives and it goes through the projects which have been identified in order to achieve the specific objectives, the four of them that we've mentioned in the presentation. So the first one, capability of center of government for strategic leadership and capacity of the public service. The establishment of a national planning commission in the presidency and the development of a policy on performance monitoring evaluation. The presidency obviously being responsible for these, and just in terms of what the main focus of activity at the moment is, obviously the production of the two green papers, which have now been published and will be debated, I'm sure, at the parliamentary level with some rigor. And that's where the major focus is at the moment. Continuing on this objective, we have also the implementation of e-government. We know there's many initiatives in the area of e-government, particularly in SARS, Department of Transport, also at the level of local government in terms of the metropolitan areas where we have electronic payments, which has been facilitated for rates and taxes. But what we want to do is establish a common platform which would ensure better integration and obviously rationalization of resources which are applied to electronic government. Also, there is the policy review which the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs is working on provincial and local government, and the expectation is that in January 2010 there will be a report made to cabinet, possibly to the cabinet of Hutler, on this matter. Strengthening human resource capacity, a focus on repositioning HR components in the public service in order to ensure that they are strengthened. Some of the issues that have arisen out of the previous presentation, for example, filling of posts, the turnaround time, all that is really part and parcel of this initiative to reposition and strengthen HR components, and we are in the process of developing a self-assessment tool which will assist departments to benchmark themselves and establish their state of readiness to implement the decentralized human resource management framework. Also, improvement of the HR planning function. All departments are required to submit human resource plans. And the aim ultimately then will be to develop an overarching public service human resource plan. To implement the public service human resource development strategy, which involves monitoring the submission of implementation plans by departments, and then also publishing an annual human resource development performance report. Improvement on the quality of HR information. We are focusing on updating departmental organizational structures so that at least when we talk about the issue of vacancy rates, we're talking about reliable information. Because often changes are made to organizational structures, they're not updated on peristyle, and then when we make assessments of vacancies, we come up with a picture which is not 100% accurate, and hence the need for other kinds of studies which have been undertaken by the Public Service Commission, including other organizations which have done that. Also, a focus on monitoring compliance with the basics of administration, developing a manual to assist in this, looking at the filling of SMS posts in the public service to ensure that DG, HOD, and DDG posts are filled within 12-month periods, looking at the filling of SMS posts within 6 months of them being vacant, and reducing the middle management vacancy rate to 11 to 15% of funded posts. Also a focus on the implementation of the framework for the occupational specific dispensation. The OSDs have by and large been implemented. There is one outstanding, and that is the allied health workers, the therapeutics, the psychotherapists, occupational therapists, and so on. That's the only outstanding OSC. It is currently in the bargaining council under negotiations, and we anticipate by the end of this month, early next month, it will be completed and thereby be ready for implementation. Also then, increasing the recruitment, employment, retention of people with disabilities in the public service, as well as women in the senior management service. The newly established Department of Women, Children and Persons with Disabilities is going to be focusing on factors hindering government's progress in meeting equity targets. And then from the side of the Department of Public Service and Administration, we'll be looking at compliance, and we just have provided the latest figures where the percentage of women in the SMS stands at 34.735%, and disabled people in the public service stands at 0.21%, and the targets there show that we still got some work to do in order to achieve those particular targets. Again, within this objective of building capability at the center of government, we have a leadership and management development program, a number of them, which are led by PALAMA, the Executive Development Program. These are the targets which have been set. The Massified Induction Program, government-wide M&E system training, and the gender mainstreaming training, and this is what is intended in terms of the number of senior managers trained, and so on and so forth. We also have, I think, what is quite exciting for us now, got National Treasury more involved in the program of action. And we have a number of projects led by the National Treasury to improve the quality of financial management across government, the implementation of a tool to assess supply chain management capability maturity, a tool to assess financial management capability maturity, increasing the absorption capacity and depth of exposure of the program to train chartered accountants, and to implement a financial management capacity building model with competency standards, assessment, and development of a curriculum framework. So these initiatives are obviously focused on the need to strengthen financial management, the need to bring down the number of qualified audits or audits with emphases of matter, and so on. And we have also initiatives by the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, one focusing on debt collection and revenue enhancement, to develop an enhancement strategy and to launch a campaign, as well as Operation Clean Audit, which is focusing very much on provincial and municipal governments, establishing structures which will support the strengthening of the quality of financial management and the audit outcome at the provincial and local government level. There is also initiatives in terms of legislative reform, the Municipal Property Rates Amendment Bill, and the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Amendment Bill. Other initiatives on the side of Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs to build the capacity of local government include the development of a framework on the classification of posts in local government, establishment of a coordinating framework for the deployment of scarce skills and technicians at local government level, an audit of the existing skills profile at the local government level, and developing a mechanism for fast-tracking of funding to affected areas in times of disasters. Moving on to the next objective, to substantially improve the delivery and quality of services, there is the project of the National Macro Organization of the State, led by the Department of Public Service and Administration, the National Treasury and Public Works. And these emanate from the restructuring of cabinet, which involved the creation of new ministries, the renaming of ministries, the splitting of ministries, and the transfer of functions between various ministries. In terms of political oversight for this program, the Minister for Performance Monitoring and Evaluation is responsible for that. The technical work is done by the joint team headed by the DPSA. And obviously what we're trying to achieve through this is better coordination and hence improved service delivery by ensuring that various functions in government are better aligned. Another initiative focuses on the Tusong Service Centers, and there is a review which GCIS is currently completing, which looks at how we can strengthen the way in which the centers function, but we also want to look at a framework for the delegation of authority, and that's something that the Department of Public Service is looking at. Also a focus on the improvement of frontline officers, to improve their performance, and this involves a number of different aspects, the physical layout, the implementation of like a TV, and then also the whole area of service standards, to ensure that departments, as required by the regulatory framework, do in fact set those standards, do in fact display them publicly and prominently, and ultimately, where both the department and the commission would come in at a later point, is then to monitor whether or not these standards are adhered to. We have done some interesting work in terms of accessibility standards, monitoring whether departments have these, and we've looked at the rural development nodes using a GIS system, and we have seen that there are some challenges in regards to the accessibility standards, but I'm just mentioning this as an initiative which supports the overall thrust, which is to make sure the standards are in place and that ultimately these are adhered to. Then obviously from the side of people on the ground and the way in which they interact with government, the OPSC over the years has been undertaking satisfaction surveys, and these will continue to assist us to see how people on the ground engage with government and what their perceptions and experiences of services are, and that's what the aim of these surveys are. The next objective pertains to culture and practice of transparent, honest, and accountable public service, a number of areas of work in terms of anti-corruption, one of which is a capacity building program to ensure that we build capacity at the departmental level to deal with the different aspects which they need to deal with in order to prevent corruption and also to combat it at the departmental level. We also, together with other role players, including the Office of the Public Service Commission, are looking at the establishment of a corruption management information system to monitor incidents of corruption in the public service. Because I think one of the big challenges we have is quantification. And generally, internationally, most surveys on corruption focus on perception. Because corruption, as we know, is multifaceted, and it's got different implications, and measuring it is actually a challenge globally in terms of really being able to say these are the number of incidences of corruption. So we are looking at taking the legislation and the various definitions of different forms of corruption and then seeing the different information sources which we could use. Obviously, information which is held by the police, the prosecuting authorities, and departments. And one of the challenges is these systems don't talk to each other, just in terms of the way in which data is collected, in terms of the way in which various acts of corruption are classified. So it is a very complex project, actually, but we feel it's very important to give it a good shot and see if we can come up with more accurate quantification on the subject. Then the conflict of interest framework, we have engaged with the committee. It is currently in the cabinet system. I think the next meeting we'll have will be in October, where we will have an engagement with the cabinet on this particular matter. We also want to focus on implementation of two very powerful pieces of legislation. And that's the Promotion of Access to Information Act and the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. And we have different initiatives within this on the side of the Commission, monitoring whether the public has access to information, and on GCIS to publish all contact details of information officers, and then from the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, providing training to organs of state on promotion of promotion of Administrative Justice Act, and then conducting awareness campaigns aimed at educating society at large about their rights as contained in PAJA. Because I think this is a critical thing. This legislation works best when citizens know their rights and then they engage with government around information and issues of administrative justice. But otherwise, departments, the likelihood of them being proactive in these areas is quite remote. So we're hoping that we will get the citizenry mobilized in order to make these pieces of legislation or to bring them more to life, as it were. Also, from the side of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, facilitating the designation of the magistrates' courts as courts that can hear matters relating to PAJA, ensuring the deputy information officers are appointed and trained, and then ensuring publication and annual update of a manual with all information about the body and the services it provides, and then each body to submit an annual report to the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development in terms of Section 32 of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. So the focus is very much on building awareness and building capability both at the level of the citizenry as well as at the level of government institutions to bring these pieces of legislation more to life. On the fourth objective of strengthening engagement with society, we're looking at a number of areas of partnership, social partnership, improving public participation through the Izimbizo, which GCIS leads, and then convening the public sector summit, which in terms of the program of action the DPSA is responsible for. It is an initiative that comes out of the Public Service Coordinating Bargaining Council, and there's obviously a partnership between government as the employer, labor, and the PSDBC itself. Then reviewing government strategy on public participation and a review of the Community Development Worker Program. Revising and implementing a national program of support for the Institution of Traditional Leadership, Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, and then facilitating the rollout of the National Framework on Ward Funding Model, and implementing the APRM program of action and mainstreaming APRM, African Peer Review Mechanism, related projects in all departments. And also developing a clusters communication strategy for the cluster to profile the various activities within the program of action. On the side of strengthening democratic institutions, the presidency is responsible for developing a coordinated response to the recommendation of the ASMAL committee, which focused on the Chapter 9 institutions as well as Chapter 10 Public Service Commission. And then Department of Justice and Constitutional Development focusing on an educational program on the importance of the Constitution and constitutional bodies. Just to give an indication to the committee on the timelines we're working on, the program of action was published on the government website on the 12th of August. Later this week, tomorrow, we'll be having a review on progress in preparation for the first report. So in a month's time, then we will actually look at all the reports from all the departments on these projects, which we've outlined in this report to the committee. And then on the 4th of November, we will actually be presenting the report to Cabinet on progress and implementation. And the following week, there will be parliamentary briefings by coordinating ministers on the implementation of the program of action, and there will be final reports which will also be then submitted to the Cabinet Lekutla. Of course, this cycle, because of the elections and the establishment of a new cabinet and government, is slightly out of sync with the normal, but this is how it's going to work for the remainder of this year and when the report will come out. So obviously in November there could well be engagements at parliamentary level, and if obviously the committee would want to call us, that would be the timing. In conclusion then, I think what we have made progress in through the establishment of the clusters is better integration. I think the silos still exist, but I think at least we have a framework through which we can address the silo effect, and the impact is obviously uneven. In certain areas, there is progress in terms of breaking down silos. In others, we still have departments working in silos. But I think obviously what has been important is that the program of action provides focus for the clusters. So it really forces the clusters to work in a more integrated and harmonized way. And at the same time, Cabinet monitors the program on a regular basis, and that allows for progress reporting. And obviously as well, ultimately through the public presentations which happen to the media and the publication of the progress reports on the government website, we do have greater transparency, and it is part of the overall program of trying to build participatory governance. So I think at that level we do have very important practices which have emerged, which need to be consolidated and deepened. And then finally, just to emphasize that the program of action that we've developed is derived from the medium-term strategic framework. That is a translation of the election manifesto into a five-year program. And the overall objective is to improve the quality of life for the people of South Africa.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Honourable members, I'm sure that is a program presented by the department, and there might be issues that you really want to raise. But I must indicate that we think the presentation was not starting to guide us in terms of the direction that the department in its last profession are moving in. Any hands from the members? Yes, Honourable Praya.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I'm going to exercise my right to be critical and to do my oversight seriously to the utmost now. So please bear with me. But I'm extremely simple. Reading through the documents and listening to the presentation, I see restructuring, clusters, working sessions, briefing, drawing up programs that comes up quite regularly, new structures again, developing frameworks, surveys, another framework, so we go on. We're going to submit annual reports, we're going to have a new manual, and so on and so forth. Another, develop a coordinated response and develop an educational program. Madam Chair, I can see that the DG has got a doctorate, because it's very theoretical. It's all up there, concepts, but it's vague. We need action now. We need to implement. We need to take concrete steps. If we want to improve the quality of life, if we want to deliver proper services to all our citizens, we've actually got to take some concrete steps. New structures is not going to, it's not going to help us do that. And you don't need to be a rocket scientist to do that. The answers are actually given to us by all the reports of the Public Service Commission, year after year, report after report. We've just got to make sure that the managers sign their key performance agreement. We've got to make sure that they submit their financial declaration. We've got to fill the vacancies that are there. And they just, when people are caught out with their fingers in the cookie jar, we prosecute them. We institute disciplinary action. And after you've dismissed one or two or three people, the others will quickly fall in line and they will start taking their job seriously. They will stop being rude to the public. They will stop taking time off arriving late, leaving early, and so on. The culture that we want to entrench in public service will start correcting itself when we start taking concrete action. So I'm really saying this is fine, and it's probably taken hours and hours, maybe days, weeks, to develop this. But I don't see, it's not structures that will actually make change. The changes are the people who are in the positions, and they must do their job. So the managers must manage. And we mustn't stop new structures, new this, more manuals. I'm exacerbated by this. It's really exhausting. While people on the ground are suffering because they don't have clean water. They can't get an injection at the hospital. They've got to wait for months to get an operation. That's the problem. We must stop, we must get to basics right. And we must start with action, and some we must want to see consequences for people not doing their jobs. That's the thing that will solve the problem. So I'm very skeptical about this, Madam Chair.
Okay, that is Honourable Dreyer. That's the issue she's raising. Do we have other issues to be raised? Honourable Rasul, Honourable Ramatlakani, and Honourable November. Honourable Rasul, you start. Okay. Let's proceed to Honourable Ramatlakani.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I just want to ask this question. On the slide number 9, you're talking about this developmental state. Now, I just want to ask the question in terms of the department thinking around this. There's been a discussion around the issue of the cooling off period in the public service with respect to DGs. When they leave the cool-off period, they don't do contracts with the department that they either were leading. What is then the thinking in terms of the professionalizing of the public service, particularly the top echelon of management, in relation to this developmental state? Is there thinking that is already beginning to crystallize? Because if you say there is a cooling off period of this many years without having gone to into a professionalization that is beyond the 5 years, I'm just wanting to hear what the department is thinking around that, because there seems to be some contradiction. The second point I want to ask, there is a point about African peer review somewhere in the slide. It's written in a sense that it's a separate process that must find a way to get into government program on department program. Isn't it that the African peer review, particularly what is contained in a document, has been the things that have been picked up already in the country for the last year or so, which are supposed already to be integrated as part of program of action? I'm just having a difficulty in reading it and not saying that the African peer review mechanism, things that have come up, whether it's the issue about crime, whether it's the issue of this, has already been found expression within the program of action in terms of government. So here it looks like it's still going to have to be put into the document. Those are the two questions for now.
Thanks, Honourable Ramatlakane. Honourable November.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't know whether mine is a comment or is it a question, but you will decide. A lot is being said about clusters, intergovernmental forums, but really there is nothing that is coming out of that. I'm saying this because I've seen that in each department or in the municipalities, when it is talked about IDPs, all eyes are looking to the municipalities. Whilst I think when one is talking about IDPs, all departments have to come along as an intergovernmental forum, not to waste money of having here a meeting. Here is a forum now, a cluster forum or an intergovernmental forum, but there is nothing that is coming out of it. What I want to suggest, if it is a suggestion, is that at grassroots level, this is becoming really a problem. because municipality in the mayor's office has got something on HIV and AIDS. The Department of Health, the Department of whatever, why can't we really pull together and do one thing? All of us, one thing, so that we should know, or rather saying, HIV and AIDS belongs to the health department. Let's pull it out from the municipality and from elsewhere. Let them do that. Building of hospitals belongs to public works. Let's pull that out and schools. Let's pull them out from health and from education. Let them do that. So that really we can specifically look at each department that, you know, delivery is going on. The other thing, Madam Chair, really on the ground, nothing is really happening. There is here and there things are happening, but really on the ground, we're up there now. And I think we now, it's only now that we can really act. I hear a lot of monitoring, evaluating. How long does that take? Because on the ground, the people are beginning to be. In Afrikaans, they say, I love the big cribble rush. Ek sal maar nie daai woord gebruik nie. Hulle word 'n bietjie kriewel reg. Now, if we can really the monitoring issue, because that is lacking, especially on grassroots level, monitoring and evaluating. Who is monitoring who? And what is being done after all? Because if you cannot instill discipline within an institution, then we can say goodbye to whatever good and beautiful thing that the government is sitting there for the people. I thank you.
Thank you, Honorable November. Yeah, Honorable Rasul, now it's up to you.
So thank you very much, Chairperson. I think that the key question, I think that we have a slide presentation that provide an answer, but maybe I think that what the DG has omitted is to say what was the problem, to a large extent to be solved. What have been the effects of the silo system, of autonomous actions by departments or spheres of government, or of a piecemeal fragmented approach to things? Because once you start to say what was the problem also, and you begin to see the answers, then I think that one would need to ask, how does the shift towards greater integrated governance, how does that measure against international benchmarks? Have you benchmarked it against what, and where is best practice beginning to emerge? I also think that there is a new dynamic. The new dynamic is a National Planning Commission, a Department for Performance Management and Evaluation, as well as an Economic Development Department. What does that do in terms of the cluster system? Does it reduce the clusters to coordinating, and the planning and evaluation and so forth happens elsewhere? Does it share those functions with the clusters, or does it enhance the clusters having that capability to speak about at that point? Then the last thing that I would want, what facilitates cross-cluster coordination? Because you may have water affairs in one area and energy in another one and housing in another one, but none of them would necessarily meaningfully contribute towards, say, the eradication of TB. So what facilitates that cross-cluster work as well? So I thought that those are just to try and understand more the internal logic of the presentation that that we have been given here today.
Yeah. Do you want to respond to the issues that are raised there? The committee minister is here as well. There can be partnership in terms of answering.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I would rather give the DG the chance to take some of the questions. I want to come in as soon as he concludes. Okay?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the difficulty is we presenting a program. The ideal time to present is when there's been a report, and then we can step back and say, is it all academic, and is the DG a professor or a doctor or a public servant? We can say it maybe at that point. But I think right now we're just presenting the program because that's where we are in the process. Then when we present a report, we can begin to determine whether in some of the areas, even the areas that have been mentioned, whether there is progress being made. So if we're saying that the signing of performance agreements is a major concern, which it is for the department, for the committee, for the Public Service Commission, in terms of those particular activities in the program, have we made any progress? And has the cluster system, by having a coordinated effort of government, made an impact on the fact that the Public Service Commission report in X year indicated that there is very poor compliance with the signing off of performance agreements? I think that's really the point at which we can say whether the whole system is abstract and academic. But right now we're trying to familiarize the committee with the various actions and activities which are incorporated within the program. What is the problem to be solved? Within the broader context of government, there is a problem of departments duplicating one another, departments working in silos where they should be working together in order to achieve an impact. Because I think as the various inputs come as well, it's clear that if we want to deal with some of our key challenges, whether it be HIV and AIDS, whether it be tuberculosis, whether it be performance of rural schools, there needs to be an integrated focus by a number of different government institutions at national level, at provincial level, and at local level. And what the system tries to do is to bring about better coordination in order to achieve the outcome that we desire. Often it's difficult for a single institution of government to achieve a particular outcome. Even a particular level of government, if you want. It's the executive working in conjunction with parliament, working in conjunction with the judiciary, which achieves outcomes of the constitution that we seek. So I think one is just trying to explain that there are a number of key problems which require better coordination if we are to get a particular outcome. And what we then need to do is like I've indicated, once we have our first report, we can then interrogate. And I'm sure we'll find unevenness and even some of the criticisms raised, I think, would be valid. And even at the cabinet level, we do encounter the same kind of criticisms. But for example, the new macro structure of government. If we want to go into that, cabinet took a decision. The amount of work which this department has done on that is actually massive, because at a high level, it might look like a simple thing to do to create a new department, to create a new function. But it requires a lot of detailed work, which we are doing inside departments, in terms of identifying particular functions, identifying the IT resources that are allocated to that function, identifying the budget allocated to that function, identifying the human resources that are working on that function, ring-fencing all of those, and then doing the legal and regulatory work to transfer those functions, which will then allow for a more integrated approach to a particular service. So There is actually a lot of work which underlies this, and I think some of the rationales of these that the Deputy Minister may want to comment on as well. The issue of cross-cluster coordination obviously is a major issue. How do we achieve cross-cluster coordination? That would be achieved by Cabinet itself through Cabinet coming together collectively and considering the various reports, or out of the context even of the reports, identifying particular problems where you would need inter-cluster coordination. But the main sites of this coordination would be the Cabinet Mahutla and the preparations that go into that, which would include the Mahutla held at the officials level, which prepares for the Cabinet Mahutla. And then you would also get, in specific cases, the establishment of interdepartmental teams, which may be assigned to look at a specific area of concern that arises out of cluster work or the failure even for cross-cluster coordination. So maybe when one looks at the electricity crisis that we faced last year, you would have a particular interdepartmental or interministerial committee with interdepartmental teams being established to facilitate that level of coordination. The Honourable Ramatlakane has also asked some questions specifically around the cooling off period and professionalization, and then on the African peer review mechanism. At the moment, the thinking which we have around cooling off is still focused at the level of the formulations we had made towards the Public Administration and Management Bill. But I think it is complex. There was an analysis earlier this week, I think it was in the Cape Times, from someone from the Institute of Security Studies, which also was looking at the same problem. But actually the approach they were taking there was very similar to the approach we're taking, and that is cooling off is complicated. If you're saying people must cool off, what exactly must they cool off from? Because there are people who are professionals, they may be doctors, they may be lawyers working in the public service, and to have cooling off as a blanket thing actually does infringe on people's rights, because people might work as a medical practitioner in the public service, and at certain points they decide to go into private practice. Now, are we saying they can't go into private practice for 24 months or whatever? It's difficult. So what we've always argued is that from a legal and constitutional perspective, you need to focus very much on the issue of dealings with business and tendering processes. So if people have been involved in a tendering process, in the award of that tender, in the administration of that tender, and they then go and work for the company that has won that tender, that is where you must have legal provisions, which include criminal charges. In other words, you criminalize that particular aspect of it, which would prevent people from awarding those tenders, having business dealings, awarding licenses, and then going and working for those companies which have received those licenses or tenders and so on and so forth. So I think the cooling off period, therefore, is quite focused on that. The issue in which it intersects with the question of professionalization of the top echelon, I think that has been a burning question for a long time. Cabinet is currently considering the whole question of the turnover rate of heads of department and DGs. The thinking at the moment, as far as I understand, is not to move away from the contract system. But I think, yes, that is identified as a key challenge. As long as that top echelon is on contract, there's always going to be a level of instability. And it does, in a sense, open up for the conflict of interest that I think the Honourable Member is talking about. Because if people are insecure and they're thinking about their future, then they want to think about it now, because obviously they enjoy quite a good lifestyle. Well, you know, I mean, the top echelon of the public service, some people would argue is underpaid. I wouldn't argue that myself, but certainly if you want to maintain that level, then you can't wait till the day your contract ends to start applying for jobs or looking for opportunities. And I think that's the problem that you're speaking to. And it does tend to lead to issues of conflict of interest. People have beginning to develop interest in private entities and so on, which often might be in conflict. So I think that is an area of challenge in the public service. Not necessarily here in this country alone. I think in many countries there is this issue around that top echelon. Before, as you know, we used to have permanent secretaries. Do we want to move to a situation where we entrench that top level? They become permanent secretaries. Politicians come and go, and the permanent secretary lives through, in cases, decades of different politicians. But I think the general feeling that has swept across the globe in the last 20 years is that leads to a very sort of undynamic public service. So I think that's why generally there's been a movement away from a permanent secretary system towards a contract system for the top echelon. On the APRM, although it may appear on the program of action as a separate item, what we have attempted with the APRM is to create maximum synergy with the government program of action. But obviously the APRM is multi-sectoral, and it involves civil society and business, who must also take various actions, sometimes in partnership with government or sometimes within their own sectors. So there is quite a lot of synergy between the Program of Action for the African Peer Review Mechanism as well as the Program of Action of government. But there are areas in the APRM Program of Action which may be outside government's Program of Action. So I think it's always desirable to have synergy, also because of the scarcity of resources, and also to avoid the problems that the Honourable Dreyer has referred to, where you've just got hundreds of programs running simultaneously without being properly implemented, without having the impact that is sought or desired. So I think that's maybe the response to that question. To the Honourable November has raised a number of problems. I think from where we sit in this cluster and the major focus which might address at least from a governance perspective, the very real challenges that the Honourable Member has pointed to coming from people on the ground is the Single Public Service Initiative, which will attempt to get much better synergies within the public service across the different spheres and to have a harmonized approach to rationalize the distribution of resources, as well as to optimize the deployment of human resources, to make sure that we have the right levels of management in the right place, to have sure we are able to get the right skills in the right place, and not have all the skills bottled up in offices in Pretoria, but to try and ensure that we spread those skills out and get them to the places where they are needed in order to make sure that the policies and programs of government are implemented thoroughly. Thank you. I'm not sure if the Deputy Minister wants to come in now.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I thought that the questions, in a sense, were adequately addressed by the DG, but the comments I want to make in response to some of the issues raised are the following, that I think the presentation dealt with three very material things. The first one was that it described the system of governance that we have, which is the cluster system. And the second thing is that it made reference to the framework of strategic priorities that is guiding government's program. And key amongst that, the presentation focused on an elucidation of strategic priority number 10, which really sets the agenda for the focus of this cluster, and in a sense constitutes the remit of this particular committee's work of oversight. It talked about the four programmatic thrusts of strategic priority number 10, which is essentially targeting the need for us to ensure that we guarantee the delivery of an effective, efficient, democratic developmental state. And there are four thrusts that the presentation identified. Now, in respect of one of the critical elements of retooling the state, the program talks about the NMOS project, which is the National Restructuring Project of Government Departments, which also is being led by the DPSA, which is trying to reorganize at a national level the various departments. And that's quite critical, because it's critical to the state having to reform this instrument of government. And the DPSA is charged with that responsibility to lead that process in government. I think the second focus of the programmatic thrust has to deal with three critical areas of work. The first one is all the project initiatives that this cluster has to deal with that focuses on service delivery improvements, which is where I think Honorable Dreyer is coming from when she says that we need to focus on what are the action points rather than all of these other things. So service delivery is an essentially important component thrust of the program of activities. The second one is the integrity management within the state. It has to deal with the conflict of interest, the accountability of public officials, the question that was raised by Honorable Ramaphosa about the cooling off period and all of that. So those are all the kind of initiatives that will be taken to ensure that the integrity framework within the state is actually put in. And the third one has to deal with the democratization and public participatory strategies to ensure that the state becomes an instrument that is closer to the people. And here it's the mechanisms of the two song centers, the community development workers, and all those initiatives that bring government closer. But I think that overarching all of this, it's important that we graph two very central initiatives that the state is embarking on. And that has to deal with the definition or the move inside government towards the creation of what we might define as a performance or outcomes orientated democratic government. It's very important. This whole restructuring thing and the creation of the planning commission and the performance and monitoring initiative within the presidency is to fashion the move towards the development of an outcomes-based government. A government that can be measured on performance outcomes that are defined at the beginning of its term, not at the end. In other words, if we want to measure the performance of a government, we need to know what is the outcomes we are driving towards, so that at the end of the day and during the process, we're able to measure the progress by which we achieve those outcomes. And now, in that instance, the Planning Commission is very central. If you look at the green paper that's out, the central thrust of the Planning Commission is to develop a process of national consensus building inside the country through the work of the Planning Commission to define these performance outcomes, both for society as a whole and for the state in particular. And it's intended that these outcomes will be defined through a very elaborate participatory process in which various stakeholders must have an interest. That's why the commission is seen to be an externally appointed commission of experts to work this process through with stakeholders outside government, and then to be able to translate the performance outcomes into something that becomes measurable policy within government. So that planning commission is important. It will define those performance outcomes. And then the second thing that government is attempting to do is to narrow down the priorities so that we begin to define in very clear terms. And the debate right now is like we've got five priorities. And is that okay, or should we even narrow it further? But that's the debate that's emerging around this question of priorities and performances. And once we're able to settle those particular questions, we will then be able to put in place performance appraisals that would determine how ministers perform, how public officials perform, and how ministries and clusters perform that drive us towards the outcomes as a society we've already achieved. So I think those are very, very important components of the discussion that must frame our understanding of how we exercise this oversight process. The last thing let me just say is that I often, when I listen to us all together, collectively speak about service delivery, the question that comes to my mind is, have we sufficiently understood the complexity of the problems around challenges in service delivery? And I suspect that we have not given ourselves the opportunity to discuss and debate and understand this sufficiently deep enough. I have become convinced that I think what is required is a much more deeper probe on the question of service delivery. I do not think that it's as simple as an issue of councillors are not doing the work, lazy public servants, or incompetent ministers. And my suggestion would be that I think in the work of this committee, since service delivery is a very critical and core element of it, we should consider putting together an opportunity for us to really interrogate this over a longer sort of time engagement, maybe a kind of, you know, workshop, seminar type thing for 3 or 4 hours or something like that, with some people to lead the input, so that we can find some kind of collective understanding on a consensus basis on what do we mean when we say there are these service delivery problems, service delivery challenges, and how we should go forward. This might just top of my sort of head reflection on it. But I do think that what it calls for is a much more serious interrogation of this problem of service delivery. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any burning issues from the members? Perhaps maybe if you want to raise something, you still have chance. But what I just needed to sort of raise is these few issues. Of course, the DG were not setting you up when you said give us an overarching, you know, existence of the cluster and how it functions. It was important for us to start to know where it is and how is it happening. And of course, the members would always be critical in terms of, you know, I'm sure you heard they talk about the programmatic nature, they want to see things happening. What we can talk about is that in terms of the program that the committee has planned, our interaction on the strategic planning session, your response in terms of identifying that when we move into, is it a November, the November approach, it will be talking to issues that members really want to hear, what is happening, what are the implementation, which therefore means that we will grow in terms of this input and into the issues that we all look forward into. Of course, we all agree that we must locate it within the programmatic, you know, because we want to see the oversight in terms of the program, that is fine. But that opening and introduction in terms of this is what we're doing becomes critical, so that when we go deep, we know the overarching strategy of what is it that we talk about. You talk of governance and administration. We talk of, I would say, of and monitoring on our side, so which therefore would actually relate to one another in that same way. I think you have gone further to emphasize, you know, I think the members did show that there was less impact, particularly on the municipalities. You know, we still have a hangover from the elections. We went to the elections, we went to municipalities, it was bad. So it's still in the back of our brains that things are not really happening. And members were reflecting on those issues. So it actually means then, when you talk overview, what does it relate to the municipalities? But we can confidently indicate that when we talk about the public administration bill that has indicated that it's coming our way, part of it is to address how we can then move this, you know, into the municipalities in terms of the single public service that you always talk about in relation to the implementation of some of the work that you want to do. DG, you will remember with the deputy minister that when we had that strategic planning session, let's agree that the issue of a bathroom center wasn't really clearly addressed. And in our own view, those areas are existing where, you know, in the remote communities where, if they work well, it's part of that integration would be seen quite visibly. I'm actually raising this in the light that there is a 10-minute request that we're requesting with members, because we'll be doing the committee oversight. You know, I don't like a situation where it's like we're tripping you, that something is not happening, going there, we come back and say, oh, the bathroom I mess. But I want a situation where we can say, in our overview, where in our monitoring and overviewing the work that we're going to do, it's important, especially if something comes very clearly that it's not functioning well, would have interest as the members of parliament to say, why is this thing it's not working, because the concept, the idea is quite good. It's the integration, the implementation. And we do pick up interest as members that perhaps during this period, part of it, we'll see how do we do it, you know, in terms of maybe various constituencies, or would identify a few where we definitely want to go and look into, but they have to work. So as we would be fussy about it, and we'll actually make sure that something happens along that side. So those are some of the things that would definitely request the department to actually look into, because we are going to also move along that direction. But I must say that there was an issue that was raised again, you know, in the beginning of this year. I know it wasn't within the committee itself, but the issue of our audit reports within departments have come out very bad most of the time. And there was a suggestion that there's a pool of CEOs, CFOs, that are there in the National Treasury that can be distributed one per department, which it will be interesting if the department can follow up on that issue and make sure that there are people who can assist. Because, yes, it's wrong for us to say at the end that, you know, the auditor's general outcome in terms of, oh, this is bad, without necessarily taking precaution in advance before that happens. So part of it, I think, is step one, if we have people who relate quite directly with that professional analysis of the accountability budgeting, if that can be followed up and we have those people, you know, because I know that commitment was done prior to even the minister who is in the planning in the presidency moved there, that commitment was done, so that we follow it up. It will be within the interest of public safety administration to get that area right. So those are some of the things I just needed to just raise, that what if we look into those things that way. But truly, we will look into the programmatic approach. We've seen that you've got the November 1, which we're picking up. No, it's ours. It's a proposal. The committee would be in November, would be looking into the areas of, you know, would be evaluating the implementation of the work. It's still a proposal that the committee is going to adopt. We're looking at the implementation of the program of action. So it tallies with what DG said, that, you know, there will be also those areas that you'd like to move into. I'll just check from the members, issues that you want to raise. Otherwise, I also need 10 minutes of your time before we break after that discussion. Honorable Rasul's hand is up. Honorable Malula, your hand is up. I'll take both of you.
Chairperson, just very quickly, I think that we must respond to the invitation both by the DG and by the Deputy Minister to have a sharper debate around what is the disjuncture, what is the problem. And I thought that maybe a good entry point could be, and I may have missed it because I may not have been here last year, could be that maybe it would be a good idea to invite both the people who've done the 15-year review, as well as what has just come out now, the household survey, about what is the extent and the rate of poverty on the ground, so that we can sharpen our own understanding about what is the problem. Because depending on where we stand, some would see the problem as being corruption, others would see the problem as being resources not being present, others would see the incompetence of the state, others would see the systems of the state not working together. And maybe that could be a very useful thing to try and understand. If we sit with two, one government, one outside government, and we're able to say, this is what the household survey is telling us, this is what the 15-year review is telling us, these are the assessments of strengths and weaknesses, and how do we put together a composite report so that we read it in the context of the state of the public service and everything like that, and try and build a picture so that when we go on site visits even, we are able to ask, to go to the right places, ask the right questions, and to be able to do that evaluation for ourselves. So I'm making that as a proposal for one of the activities that this committee could engage itself in.
Thank you, Chair. We hope that the action on the document will be made. As we see, the DDG is trying to implement one of the Waterbury principles by wearing the name tag. So we hope everything will go well, starting from today as he started by implementing the principles. Thank you. I think we were in agreement so far. DG would expect much more. I'm sure you'll expect more from us as well in terms of active interaction. Honorable Rasol's proposal is very critical. I'm sure we all accept it. And in moving forward, that will help. I'm sure the department does accept. You know, DG?
Thanks. Chairperson, maybe just in response to your point that you made, just to emphasize, as I indicated, that GCIS is currently conducting a major review of the Tusong centers, and I think we would need to make that available, even if it's not a formal meeting. It's something that the committee would probably want to look at, which would also assist you in your outreach program. So I think we, as soon as that one is public, we should make sure that you get a copy of that one. Thanks.
Honourable members, I think if we don't have any other issues to raise with the department, we'd just would like to thank the DG and the whole department, the Deputy Minister, for always being available when they are required to be here, and we are looking forward for much more interaction. Don't forget the anti-corruption strategy. That's another area of focus, but integrated now, pulling all aspects of, you know, other things I knew they just done yesterday, so we must give it time. And then thereafter we can talk about that approach. But I would like to even thank the Public Service, the Commission, they're still here. We are looking forward for continuous interaction. Thank you very much. Thank you, Deputy Minister. So I hope the copies of the minutes have been also distributed to members. Okay. Do you all have copies of the minutes? It's four sets. The other set is the 7th of August, followed by the 19th of August, then the 26th of August, and then the 2nd of September. Members will just go through minutes then, and then I know the minutes have been sent before, né? So if the members are okay, can I start with the 7th of August maybe? Okay, Honorable Pascal, please. Okay, we'll second that by Honorable Russell. Okay. Reserve the minutes for the 7th of August are fine. Yes, the Honorable Chair has actually moved and it was seconded by Honorable Russell. Okay. The next set of 5 minutes is the minutes for the 19th of August. Okay. Honorable Van Kerk, please. You're fine with them. So, Honorable Malulego, you're seconding. So the two sets are fine so far. The 7th and the 9th. Thank you. So we are following. You move that we adopt. Okay. Any second for the 26th, Honorable Ramatakani, Honorable Bishiku, and Honorable Samstaki. So we are left with just the last set, which is the 2nd of September. Okay. Honorable Van Kalkbeek is moving for the adoption. Any second? Honorable Suleiman. No, it can be. Yes, honorable member, I was called by the chief group on a very urgent meeting. Very strange. Seconded by honorable Rasso. Oh, yes, you will sign the last letter of the doing that quick. Thank you. Honorable Gray. Yeah, we do need, you know, sometimes we squash. The last meeting was quite badly. The last issue, we still have 5 minutes. The last issue is the issue of we need to prepare and plan for, we've got a period between the 6th to the 9th where we can do committee overview, oversight during that period. We briefly thought about the Tucson centers. If members do accept that the Tucson maybe can serve as a priority for this period, there are two ways that we can approach it. Perhaps we can identify maybe 3 or 5, depending on how do you want to do and go as a committee, or we identify them all, but members spread across the constituency areas to look into those centers, and then we come together to do a consolidated report. I wanted us to look into it and then agree what kind of an approach would you like to engage in. Of course, we would require also the report that the DG talked about, the GIS, because it will guide us. You know, we go through that GIS report and we need to know all the location of those centers, which will make it important. Honorable Rasul signed this up.
Jefferson, why don't we have the visits over those number of days, but I think that in a sense the first day and a half we could really try and each one just assess so that we get a broad provincial view, and that yourself identify what should be visited together, whether we go to one province to visit it together, and we could do it on a base of where we see best practice and where we see worst practice, so that so over the other day and a half we could be spread over. So maybe for all of us to bring together a composite national report from Tucson centers in our own areas, in our own provinces and so forth, and then for the rest of the time identifying a few that we visit together that we believe is good practice and bad practice, and then I think that we would be able to have a far more intelligent assessment of the Tucson centers, but preceded of course with the GCIS input.
Honorable Kreya, thanks. Honorable Rosso.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm quite happy to agree with that proposal. I think how many of us are on your thing, however many. If we all spread out across the country, we can really cover a very wide area and a huge number of systems.
Mm-hmm.
I go to Hotel, and members of Scotland go to the Northern Cape, et cetera, et cetera. But I think we need a kind of a sheet, so we all check the same thing, and we can all check yes or no, or assess from 1 to 5 in this point in terms of what we found there on the number of criteria that the members of the staff, where they're wearing their identification badges and so on and so forth, we can have a number of criteria that we can check off. Mm-hmm. And then we can get together and visit as a committee. But then we will really have a lot of information that could be very valuable. So I'd go along with that.
Okay. Now, I think we'll work on that approach. But also, maybe we'll sit down with the secretary, identify, spread them across. You know the constituency, we don't know all constituency areas for members. Maybe we will consult with you on that one, but also identify the ones that we think we can go. But we'll do a bit of a research and we'll give you feedback in terms of how we're going to approach it. And thank you very much for the cooperation, honourable members. Then we'll get feedback from us then, along with what you've raised. Yes. Oh yes, and in fact they... Okay, come again, one of them. You're budgeting already. Please. Unfortunately, there is a national treasury training. No? After this, okay. You know, members, we have a choice for next week. You know, we can take that national treasurer's training that time and we're finished with it. We don't locate it within the constituency where there's two songs that you want to focus on. We can proceed to be part of all, there will be two songs, there will be it as well. So we've got a choice that we can do it, finish it, then we are finished about that commitment you made. And you remember, I wasn't even there. Yes, there's a commitment already. But we can also, it can also be done during the constituency period of time. You want to talk on that later? Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just on the National Treasury training, we have been in contact with National Treasury trying to establish costs, which the last committee meeting resolved that I should do. They believe that it would be best to rather have a briefing to familiarize the members on how to evaluate the financial reports and add value to the members' oversight. That could be done next term as part of the annual report oversight scrutiny that the committee is going to do, or it could be done next week, Wednesday, or it could be done end of committee period.
Now that Reza is speaking of costs, I think, you know, it's, when we're here, they're coming and there are no much costs from our side. So in terms of issues of costs, it's cheaper for us to get that kind of training where they are coming and they're prepared to do so by next week. Then, but when we have to go to Pretoria with flight tickets, you know, we might want that money for something else. So can we, please, one of the members agree that we could, we'll take you Wednesday. Okay, thank you very much.